It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is indeed my show. And today we are back with Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling in Japan. And we're looking at FMW, their 6th anniversary show from 1995, because we're looking at 1995 at the minute. Now, my regular crew this weekend with Strong Style Evolved, what have you, are all unfortunately unavailable. We've got Cy and Alex have gone off to Strong Style Evolved in Manchester, I think. Chelsea's on a family visit. Marcus has got family stuff to deal with, and Alex is away for the weekend. So to come and salvage the Troopany Show honour from the Total Wrestling Writers podcast is Mr. Mike Freeland. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing fantastic, and thank you so much for having me on the program.
That's okay. We appreciate your time. Now, Mike has been hosting the Total Wrestling Writers podcast for a few weeks now. If you want to go over and listen to it, I've been a guest on it a couple of times, and it's a fun podcast to do. It kind of looks at pro wrestling news all through the week. What got you into wrestling to start with, sir? I should ask you that. And what have you been? What is your normal fare?
Wow. Let's see here. What originally got me into it was WrestleMania III. I am over here in the United States, and I had watched wrestling from, I would probably say, the age of 5 on. I was a big Hulkamania fan growing up, had the t-shirts and everything, the bandanas and, you know, the wristbands. So that's what first got me into it. And I loved it so much that I started to go to garage sales and, you know, just different kinds of street sales and whatnot, and see what kind of old toys I could pick up. So I started collecting that kind of stuff. And then I would go to flea markets and pick up more stuff and talk to other people who ran booths. And I finally, when I was in high school, I started writing. I was big into creative writing. And I took an English class, an upper level English class, and I went ahead and I started writing different papers and whatnot on wrestling itself. And just found it to be fascinating. And somebody said, you know what, you should probably see if you can get involved in it in some way. There's a guy named Les Thatcher who is really, really well known in wrestling as far as training. He had a territory in the Cincinnati area, and it was called Heartland Wrestling. And I called him up, and I spoke to him, and I said, is there anything I can do to volunteer, help out? You know, this is me in high school. And he said, sure. He said, do you you know any high school kids who play in bands? And I was like, yeah, I know a few people. And he's like, well, if you want to work with us on a wrestling show and you want to get a band to play during intermission, I would love that. So that's kind of how the conversation started. Started working with Les, started going down to the training facility, watching some of the guys, and really starting to educate myself on how the industry itself worked. And the more I spent time with Les down there, the more I started to realize there's a lot to this. And this is a very, very difficult industry, not only from the standpoint of it's hard to break in, but it's hard sometimes to get gigs and it's hard to get paid, you know, working all these times of shows. So I did that. And someone else told me, they said, you like writing, don't you? I said, yeah, I do. So I started writing storylines and scripts and sending them to the WWE. And James, this was probably the highlight of my career. So I am, 17 years old. I wrote WrestleMania. And I think this was WrestleMania. God, I'm trying to think here now. Maybe 16, 17. And I wrote different things, and I wrote the Raws leading up to it and everything. And I bound all these scripts, and I spent a boatload of money, and I sent them to Jim Ross, Stephanie McMahon, sent them to Kevin Kelly. Well, Kevin Kelly ends up calling my house and says, are you a former tag team wrestler, or are you a former wrestler in general? I said, no. And I said, I'm still in high school. And unfortunately, at that time, I got the professional WWE statement of we don't accept ideas outside of WWE, et cetera, et cetera. But I still had the letters on letterhead that they had contacted me, and awesome. My interest just continued to grow. So kind of here we are today, and I was really into the podcasting world, and I decided to reach out to David Penzer, who was a longtime WCW ring announcer. And I said, let's go ahead and let's do a show. And he said, great. And that show is doing tremendous. And David is a wonderful human being. I'm so grateful to have gotten a chance to be the associate producer and a voice on that show as well. And that led me then to getting a phone call from Total Wrestling Magazine. And they said, would you like to jump on board and host our show? And here we are today. So in a very long, long detour, that's kind of where we are today.
And had you watched FMW before this?
I had seen some FMW and I had seen some matches from Japan, you know, the more the hardcore deathmatch stuff.
Yeah.
Not a ton, but, you know, over the past several days, I've been watching some of their events and the one we're going to be talking about here. And I can appreciate the art form that is Japanese wrestling. So I'm really excited to get knee deep in here and talk about this.
Okay, then. Well, let's start at the beginning. In fact, let's start last year. The last time we looked at FMW, and I think it was me and Chelsea, it might be me and Sai, we looked at the FMW 5th anniversary show, which was headlined by Jinichiro Tenryu wrestling at Sushi Inita in what was billed as Anita's lose-or-leave town match, essentially. If he lost, he would retire. Which, of course, put them in a bit of a stunk when he did lose, because they were going, oh, gear, he's got to retire. But he didn't say when he would retire. So, he announced his retirement at the following anniversary show. Clever, eh? Now, you've got to bear in mind that Sushi Inita was the biggest draw in Japanese wrestling at the time, as an individual wrestler. FMW as a company wasn't the biggest draw, but if you put Anita on a card, you were going to make money hand over fist. And when you announced that Anita was retiring, well, of course, that pumped up the ticket prices quite an alarming rate of knots. This was in the following 12 months, this was the first company ever to make $100,000 in one night at Currican Hall. Bearing in mind that Currican Hall only seats 1,200 people.
Wow, that is insane.
Yeah, they were making lots of money. And Anita was building up to this final match. Now, there was a lot of stuff going on in FMW in this particular time period. One of the major issues was Mr. Pogo, who was somewhat offended that he wasn't picked as his final opponent for the FMW 6th anniversary show, and he would leave the company not long after this and then come back again, because that's Mr. Pogo and that's what he did. There was the disintegration of Wing, or Wrestling International Next Generations, which was happening at the same time, and they were kind of amalgamated into the FMW roster because they'd found themselves a niche. I should explain, really. Wing had started a couple of years before when a couple of FMW disgruntled executives went and started their own company with Mr. Pogo, and they developed a whole bunch of new stars. And then when the company kind of fell apart, they went to FMW and had a FMW versus Wing feud, which was playing out during this particular card, and you'll see that. We'll talk about those matches as well. There was a bunch of stuff going on with FMW, as you can tell. Mike, do you think that's reflected in this card? Is it a bit crazy, or do you see kind of like a linear pattern with it?
I mean, I can see a little bit of a direction of which direction they're going in here, but yeah, it does start to kind of come off the wheels here when it comes to the program itself. I mean, as farther we go on into the show, things start to get a little bit little wild, to say the least.
Wild by FMW standards. Let's point that out as well. Okay, then. So the first match, as you'd expect for a Japanese card, was a couple of young boys. Rikoku Ito, he defeated Gasuku Goshigarawa in 10 minutes and 36 seconds. 10 minutes and 36 seconds of a pretty solid singles wrestling match. Not an awful lot to say more about it than this. What did you think of this as your gentle move into FMW, Mike?
No, I liked it. I liked it. It was more of the technically sound wrestling that I'm kind of more used to as far as the intensity that we would see later in the card. It was good. I liked it. The thing that I like a lot about the matches here is there's a lot of more of psychology that's being used here. I mean, you can hear the crowd responding differently to this. It was good. I would love to have seen it gone a little bit longer, but I did like the match itself.
Yeah, I mean, Ito and Goshigarawa were pretty good wrestlers. We don't hear an awful lot of more of them too much in the future of FMW, but there's a lot of changes to come in the next couple of years, as you can imagine, when their biggest draw disappears. But it was nuts and bolts good wrestling match, and you know, it kind of established this King's Road style. For those of you who don't know, we have talked about this in previous episodes, but because Anita came from the All Japan kind of tradition, the Giant Baba tradition, this is a very King's Road style All Japan kind of inspired style of wrestling. It's not necessarily like New Japan, where you've got strong style and they're trying to mix martial arts into pro wrestling. This is very much kind of like westernized pro wrestling, because you've got to consider who trained at Sushi Inita. Well, it was the Funk Brothers and Giant Baba. So it's a very traditional kind of pro wrestling in this insane environment. And when you see just a straight wrestling match, it's kind of refreshing, to be honest with you.
No, I agree with you. It's kind of like, wow, this is really neat. I like to see that the, you know, the drop kicks in the clotheslines and whatnot, it was like, really, these guys are really crisp at what they do. And that's what really surprised me at first, because I was like, I wonder if these guys are going to go hardcore right off the get-go. But it wasn't the case. And, you know, just unbelievable athleticism was shown in this one. I was digging it.
Cool. Then in the next match, we have a different style fight, which we know, as you've been watching, listening to this series, a different style fight is usually some kind of MMA or boxer versus wrestler kind of deal. Now, we've had on previous cards, we've had Trevor Burbick and, Larry Holmes and a few other former World Heavyweight Champions fighting wrestlers. But this came from the FMW's roots. FMW originally was Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. That's what FMW stood for. And originally, it was the idea was the whole thing was based around wrestler versus mixed martial artists. And even now, 6 years later, when it's really just a wrestling promotion, they've still got this element there. So Kitsushi Ueda, who's one of our favorites, purely for his glorious perm and pawntash combo, defeats Tessera Caruda, who's a wrestler, but you know, he's a pretty good wrestler as well, and a pretty good shoot style wrestler. And he's been around for a while and he's done an awful lot of work. But this is a third round knockout for Ueda in 7 minutes and 36 seconds, and far more entertaining than I've seen Ueda's stuff before. This is a booked fight, obviously. You know, there are many mixed martial arts elements to it, but generally speaking, Ueda's winning. It's just a matter of when. But this was a good piece of work, and it was actually entertaining, and the crowd were into it. What did you think of it, Mike? Because this is something you won't have seen before.
Yeah, no, I really like this aspect of it. I like the boxer versus wrestler because it does incorporate two different styles, and it definitely appeals to different fans. So you have more of a fan of a boxing, more of a combat type of sport, and then you have the wrestler itself. So it's kind of interesting. I liked it. It did kind of remind me of the Mr. T versus Rowdy Piper kind of aspect right there. But it was good. I liked it. I liked it a lot. It definitely turned up the intensity level from the first match. You're right. There was a lot of the fans were into this one. And the interesting thing about when you were watching this kind of event, you can see as the crowd continued to kind of rise up with that. So I was digging it. It was good. I took a little bit of notes here and I was like, the winner was the boxer who looked like he had the porn mustache. So that might or might not be a fair assertion to describe him, but I was liking this one. I was enjoying it.
Excellent. And the next match, as is always with FMW, because they do try and celebrate all styles of wrestling, is a lucha match, which is always a bit weird in FMW because you get lucha all over the place. And this one pitted Omega Ultra, which, believe it or not, is Damien 666, who's also wrestling later on the card, then considered one of the best junior heavyweights in the world and was in that year's trying to remember Super J Cup in which me and Chelsea talked about a few weeks ago. And Ultra Taro, who wasn't that impressive, but would actually end up being the new Psychosis in AAA a few years down the line. And they were defeated Battle Ranger Z, who was, well, let's be honest, a Power Ranger, and Mac Hayato in 15 minutes and 17 seconds in a thoroughly entertaining sing-along Lucha Libre match. What did you think of this, Mike?
I like it. I like the high flyers. I like the jumping around. I like the fast-paced intensity of the quickness of the match itself. It was something that – it was good. It was good because it was a nice contrast to what we'd seen in the first match and then obviously within the second match. They were able to go ahead and they were able to kind of transcend the different styles and make it really, really appealing so it wasn't just one match after another. These guys – and correct me if I'm wrong, was this the match where – I had made the reference that I thought the one guy had reminded me of a Bret Hart or a Hart Foundation?
Yes, it was. That'd be Mac Hayato, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Those guys look great. They looked great. Very technically sound. They reminded me a lot of like the Rockers in the 80s WWE. And it was great. I loved it. I mean, I would love to watch more of these guys because they could go and they made it believable. They could sell their asses off and it was a great match. Loved it. Loved every single second of it.
Excellent. Now we get to a bit of serious business. The FMW women's division was one of the best and hottest women's divisions in the world at the time, and they were highly represented in Joshi and highly regarded in Joshi. In part, the reason was because they had killer heels and purely sympathetic baby faces. And this match kind of really highlights that. 16 minutes and 27 seconds in a Texas Death Street fight, which featured Mad Dog Military crushing Matamore and Shark Chishiko versus Kaoru Nakayama, and they defeated Combat Toyota, Miyosu Sato, and Yukihira Ishikawa in 16 minutes and 27 seconds. Now, this was complicated because Mad Dog Military didn't want Kaoru Nakayama to be on their team, and they kept beating her up intermittently whilst trying to wrestle their opponents, and won anyway, which kind of gave you an idea that Mad Dog Military were going places in the next few weeks. What did you think of this, Mike? Because I doubt you'll have seen FMW women's wrestling before.
No, I had not prior to this. And, you know, when you're used to seeing women's wrestling in a specific type of style, when you see something like this with a street fight and where they're going basically all over the place and just ragdolling each other, it was hard because you almost kind of think, are these the guys that are wrestling or these are the women that are wrestling? Because they are so strong. And the moves that they can do are in a lot of ways superior to what you see in the United States, just from the force of strength. You know, a lot of wrestling when it comes to women, you think a lot more of the mat wrestling, a lot more of the hair pulling, maybe some high flying type of stuff. But this one was just straight out brutal. They were just kicking each other's ass and the crowd was into it. And I really, really liked it. And I'm not going to lie to you. I thought at one point in time, really glad I'm not one of those women because I think I would get destroyed by them.
Yeah. The FMW dojo was actually probably, you know, FMW women kind of had it, well, I don't want to say easy, but it was a less intense kind of, well, no, that's not really true. I'm trying to think that it seemed to be much more of a kind of we're all in this together deal. As much as there was a sisterhood in Joshi, there was a serious chip on the shoulder of the FMW women. I haven't told you this story before, but All Japan Women was the big Japanese women's promotion in Japan, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. They were like New Japan are now. And they were the biggest wrestling promotion in Japan at the time because they had more TV ratings than any other, even the men's. The men's couldn't catch up with them as far as, like, you know, TV ratings concerned. The men were getting like 5.6 ratings and they were getting 18. Okay, so
not even close.
No, and Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo, who you will see later, were in their rookie dojo in 1986, and were let go after 2 years because they weren't considered good enough for AJW. And Atsushi Inita actually went and found Megumi Kudo from the kindergarten she was working in and persuaded her to come out of retirement to wrestle for him in FMW. And he picked up Combat Toyota, who was working as a freelancer as well. And they had a bit of a chip on their shoulder to make FMW's women's promotions one of the best in the world because, you know, they'd been told they weren't good enough. And they would, God damn it, they were going to prove that they were. And they dragged the FMW roster along with them. You know, they punched well above their weight for a roster that was pretty good, really. I mean, Shark Tichiko and Christian Matamori are brilliant heels. Brilliant, brilliant heels. And you can see that the young girls in this match, like Nakayama and Sato and Ishikawa, do know what they're doing. And it would be the foundation of what would happen next for Japanese women's wrestling in FMW.
When it came to a match like this, just something that kind of just strikes me as interesting, was this more of, it seemed like it was conflicting styles. You know, you have one side who is obviously a lot more high-flying, and then you have the other side who is real brutal. Would you see a lot of this conflicting type of wrestling styles in matches in Japan, or would they try to put people who are similar?
It depends on the story you're trying to tell, I think, really. FMW kind of relied on that underdog, so you wanted babyfaces who could really sell, and you wanted bigger women in top as the heels. I mean, like, Shark Tukisho used to wrestle with the guys from time to time. If they were a man down, she'd just go and tag with them. She was doing intergender wrestling long before it became fashionable, if you see what I mean. So, it's kind of like based around like the idea of the plucky underdog in this environment works really well. In other promotions, it's much more bigger mix because they had much bigger rosters to work with, because FMW probably only had about 10 girls at one time. But you look at All Japan Women, they had 20. You know, 20 to 30 with another 10 in the dojo. So, you know, they were big companies and they had loads of variation, whereas FMW not so much. So you kind of got, you tended to get similar matches, but they brought in a lot of outside stars to vary that, to make it different, if you see what I mean. This was the first time, in fact, where it was just a straight FMW versus FMW wrestler for the FMW and WWA Women's Championship, which we'll talk about in a bit. The most of the anniversary shows had guests on from different women's wrestling companies.
The one thing I will say is I noticed a lot of chair shots in this one, and that's something you don't typically see a whole lot with women's wrestling. And they're laying them in here too, and they're taking it. And I give these girls a lot of credit, because when they're getting thrown around here, the thing about the outside of the ring, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of matting and padding. So when they take a bump, they're really taking a bump.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to bear in mind, this was still the period of you retire at 26. Now, there's two reasons for that. The reason that I'm going to bring up right now is because it was that hard on their bodies. Women's wrestling in Japan was much tougher than what the men had to go through, and it was generally considered very sensible to retire at 26. The other reason was the obvious, you know, control, sexism, all the other things you expect to tell sure. women to stop working at 26. But the actual, like, the from the physical side, you know, most, if they retired at 26, they'd retire healthy. You know, then a lot of them didn't make it to 30. When they removed that rule, Akira Hokuto, who's one of the best women's wrestlers that ever lived, didn't make it to 30 before she retired, because you had that many injuries piled up and stacked up. So, you know, it's a tough style, and they take a lot of risks, and it's not as risky as some of the men's stuff. And again, I'm not keen on chair shots to the head, ever, especially now what we know now, but even then, they were pretty stiff with everything they did, really, to be fair.
Do you think that it was a good idea to go so rough and so hardcore with some of the women, because they were such great draws and the crowd was really into them? Do you think they ever thought about maybe toning it down just a little bit to maybe extend some of those careers and make those matches a little bit more than what they were?
They did a little bit. I mean, the previous year they had, was it 2 years before, they had the tag match between Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo versus Manami Toyota versus Toshi Yamada, which is one of the best wrestling matches you will ever see anywhere. You know, they were that good. It was absolutely phenomenal. So they did have straight wrestling matches. It's just that the house style of FMW is violence, and they would go there eventually. And because they were burning through so much stuff, which is kind of the theme of this particular night, they're burning through a ton of stuff as far as storylines is concerned, including like Anita's comeback from the start of the company to now. Because they're running out of ideas, you're right. I mean, in a couple of years, Combat Toyota, definitely the next year, Combat Toyota retires. And the following two years after that, Megumi Kudo retires as well. So, it's the kind of the theme of FMW. They just burn through stuff.
Now, the one thing you were telling me before when you and I were chatting before we went on the air was that it's not uncommon to see a lot of the other individuals in the locker room come on out and be ringside during some of these matches. And that's what asked you before, when I saw a lot of the different competitors in the orange jumpsuit. So someone kind of like myself, what is that, a common thing that they always do, or is that, you know, usually brought out during special events?
It's kind of an older thing. I mean, like, you go back and watch Giant Baba versus Harley Race, and the entire All Japan locker room is in Baba's corner. So it was kind of an old school thing, and it was kind of something FMW did quite a lot, because there's a lot of support from your crew, and you don't get it so much today, especially in New Japan. I mean, obviously the Bucks or Kota Ibushi are usually second in Kenny Omega. Taka Michinoku second, Zack Sabre Jr. There's a couple of people who are known, obviously Gedo seconds Okada, but there's a couple of people who are known for it, but generally speaking you don't. It's to do with the old school factions and the way those factions worked, especially in All Japan. If you look at Burning in All Japan in the 90s, they were always supporting each other. So it's been a known thing for quite a long while. And also, if you're down there and you're at ringside, you're learning. You know, you watch, especially the younger boys, you watch all those young boys in New Japan today. There's a reason why they're all sat down by ringside and with their heads looking up at what's going on, you know.
Would you say that in a lot of ways, Japanese wrestling does do a lot more tutelage with their younger incoming wrestlers compared to maybe North American style, just because they do go ahead and they are more involved in, like you said before, coming down there by the ringside and learning? Do you feel like there is a different style as far as the educational aspect?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the dojo kind of environment is very different to a wrestling school in North America or in Europe. So, like, if you go to your local wrestling school in North America or in Europe, you pay a trainer a set fee every week. You turn up, you do your training, or you go to a camp and you learn a certain amount of stuff. Either way, it's always you paying them. Okay? And you may end up on their shows, probably unpaid, as, you know, a beginning talent. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking it. And I know quite a few promoters who do that, and that's very, very cool. But in New Japan and All Japan, it works a completely different way. There is a set number of rookies needed for the dojo every year. You go through some serious trials to get to that dojo. You've got to be that good to start with and really, really want it and be incredibly fit and show all the physical strengths. And then those five go forward to being trained by the dojo masters. And it's the same in FMW and all of the older promotions and all the promotions now. So it's a very different way of learning, but it means you're already getting the best of the best because there's those five guys or five girls, they really, really want to do it. Do you see what I mean? So it's...
No, it does make a lot of sense now. Instead of taking just a bunch of people's money and saying, hey, we'll go ahead and we'll train you. No, you have to be the cream of the crop. And then there's that continual cut down to make sure that you are definitely what they're looking for.
Yeah. And then if you survive, I mean, like, one of the young boys out of the current New Japan class, bless him, and he was absolutely brilliant, but he's had a serious injury and probably won't wrestle again. You know, and those are the risks they take. But New Japan are paying them. They're also feeding them and housing them for a year. And they will look after them. They will put them on salary when they go over to do Ring of Honor or CMLL or Rev Pro. When they do their learning excursions, they'll be on salary. They won't be paid by the local promoter. They'll be paid by New Japan Pro Wrestling. And they'll probably be on a fair bit more money than the guys who never CMLL and Ring of Honor. But, you know, that kind of different learning environment is one of the key things of why Japanese wrestling is successful, because you're getting the best and treating them the way you want them treated to get the best wrestlers. Now, don't get me wrong, there's all sorts of stuff that can go wrong in that environment because it's very open to abuse. However, New Japan's probably the most progressive wrestling company in the world right now, and it's doing really, really well. So, you know, there's plenty of good stuff too. We talked about that last week on the Make a Satoru episode and the Gaia Girls documentary, which showed, as Chelsea quite rightly pointed out, some abusive practices that went on in that dojo. So it's six of one, a half a dozen of the other. You know, if you just want to do something to keep fit and have some fun, the British and North American style is probably the way to go. I wouldn't want to be in a Japanese dojo just to have fun, because you ain't going to have fun.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you hear stories about Hiro Matsuda and what he had put, you know, the people he had trained through with. And the interesting thing about that as well is when it came to breaking into wrestling, at least from the stories I had heard with Matsuda, was that they actually took on a lot of responsibility for whoever they broke in. So if they didn't work out, that reflected negatively on them. Yeah. So it was one of those things where it was such a brotherhood, and it was such a fraternity that at the end of the day, if you were to break somebody in and you were to give them the stamp of approval, and let's say they didn't work out, that really could hurt your career long term.
Yeah, it's still kind of the similar thing. We watched that Gaia Girls documentary, you know, Miko Satomura and Sunoki Kato and Ueda, who are the trainers there, are concerned that if their girls don't make the grade, it's going to reflect badly on them. You know, the Miko Satomura says, I want them all to give the best representation of professional wrestling they can. She's so serious. And, you know, it makes your heart break because she's 22 and she's responsible for all these 18-year-olds who could screw up at any minute. You know, and do on a regular basis because they're 18 and they screw up and they're under a lot of pressure. You know, it's the tension is very palpable in these kind of environments.
And the thing you got to keep in mind is they're still kids.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, mistakes are going to happen. That's just the nature of the beast on being young and learning. And learning is a process, and making mistakes is not necessarily bad. It's one of those things that is, you know, as long as you learn from it and you grow from that, that's not a bad thing. That's a good learning tool.
Yeah, and the learning curve's steep if you're that good. Bull Nakano made her debut at 15 years old, and she was main eventing when she was 17. you know, it massive cards, like 5,000, 10,000 seaters. That's 17 years old. Mako Satomura made her North American debut on Monday Nitro at 19.
Insane. Yeah. That is literally unbelievable.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just, that's how it works. That's how they do it. You know, you're good enough. Go. So
now, a lot of people who may only be familiar with Bull Nakano from her time, let's say in WWF in the mid 90s, when she had that feud with Alundra Blaze, which really was looked at as groundbreaking when it came to WWF women's wrestling, because prior to that, I mean, Wendi Richter and some of the other women they had in there, it really wasn't. It was just basically like two wives that were just fighting over a recipe. But when it came to Bull itself, do you think that it was a good idea career-wise for her to come to the WWF, or do you think that she definitely would have been better suited if she would have stayed over in Japan?
She was done in Japan. She'd done everything. She won the WWA Women's Championship, and All Japan weren't booking her anymore, and there was nowhere else to go in 1990.
Wow.
She was done. Like I said, 26 rule. If they got to 26, that was it. You're done. Now, when JWP came along in 1992... she had some leverage then, because they didn't have the 26 rule, so she could go there if she wanted to, and All Japan started booking her again.
So many different nuances about Japanese wrestling that a lot of fans probably don't even have an idea of. No matter how over you are, if you hit certain, you know, ceilings, then really, unfortunately, you're done.
That's it. I mean, All Japan were like, well, yeah, but we've got Aja Kong, and we've got Mika Satomura. Sorry, we've got Aja Kong, we've got Manami Toyota, we've got Akira Hokuto, we've got Yumiki Hata, we've got these seven or eight women who are possibly seven or eight of the greatest wrestlers who ever lived. We don't really need you.
I don't get that from a business standpoint, though, because think about it from this perspective. If you have some of the hottest wrestlers in the world, regardless of what their gender is and regardless of what their age is, if they're performing really well and they're selling places out, wouldn't you agree, James, just from a monetary standpoint, you would try to ride that and milk that for all it's worth?
But they'd already milked Bull for 2 years as their champion. You know, by 93, she drops the title to Kong in 93. So they'd already had 2 years out of her. And that's really, they were moving on to the next thing. That this is another theme of 90s wrestling in Japan. They were burning through stuff awfully quickly. And we talk about FMW burning through stuff, but AJW did the same thing. You know, they had the best wrestlers in the world, possibly of all time ever, in any promotion, anywhere on the planet. And they were trying to build, it's top yourself, what do you do next week? Now, they weren't violent. There were some violent matches, but they weren't like FMW violent. But if you're producing the best technical wrestling in the world, how do you make that better? Where do you go next? You know, so it's a similar kind of thing.
That can be a hard transition.
We should probably get back to this card. But that's what we do on the Troopany Show. We segue. Anyway, so we'll move on to match five, which was Judge Dredd, Koji Nakagawa, and they defeated Ryo Maeki and Duk Tane in 14 minutes and 26 seconds. Judge Dredd was hilariously large and could move quite well. I liked him a lot. I'd not seen him before. He was fun.
Yeah, especially when you watch the bigger wrestlers, and you normally think that they're just going to be these brutes that, you know, have maybe one or two, three, you know, sets that they use in a match. But to see the agility is really something that's refreshing, and it was a great match. I loved it.
It was pretty good. 40 minutes, 26 seconds. Went probably a little bit long for what it was, but I'm guessing they were probably trying to fill some time, because this was a long day. You got to bear in mind, these matches like started in the middle of the afternoon, and they had to wait till nighttime to get to the main event, because you needed darkness for the main event to work. Anywho, we move on to the next match, which was the original Sheik, Ed Farrat, defeating Damien 666 in 1 minute and 47 seconds of the most mismatched match I've ever possibly come across. The Sheik at this point was in his early 60s. He was barely mobile. Took him about 15 minutes to get to the ring. But he's still the Sheik. So he was still in awe. The Japanese audience were absolutely in awe of him, despite the fact he could clearly move very, very little and only very, very slowly. Tried to set fire to Damien. Damien, who was kind of very popular amongst new FMW fans for his kind of act, which was impersonating other wrestlers and putting it into his act, didn't really get a chance to do a lot here and lost in 1 minute and 47 seconds. What did you think of this, Mike?
I was kind of like, what the hell am I watching? Like, what literally just happened here? Because I think you and I were texting back and forth, and I was like, wait a minute. That guy seems a little familiar. And you're like, yeah, he should. He's the original Sheik. And I was like, man, and there's fire. And he just seemed to be so cavalier about having the fire in itself. And just looking at him, that is the epitome of what I think old school wrestling is, because not only is he selling it, but he legitimately looks just bitterly angry and just upset. But even at his advanced age, which, I mean, I don't know if he wrestled much longer after this. I don't think he did.
No, I think it's probably his very last run.
Was he smoking a cigarette? What was going on with that? Because I saw different clips of this.
No,
and I'm thinking, what has he got in his mouth?
In his mouth he had a fork which was wrapped in white athletic tape, which was his standard thing. And he had a torch with him as well. So he's doing the fork to slice and dice and the torch to set fire. Fire was kind of a thing with the Sheik in FMW. He'd made his FMW debut, obviously, with his nephew, Sabu, a couple of years before. And they had a big feud with Tarzan Goto and Atsushi Inita, which had culminated into a fire match, which was the first time ever, where they replaced the ropes with logs soaked in kerosene.
Stop it.
No,
stop
I'm not kidding. This is a bad idea, isn't it? And before you start. Now, obviously, you can't have that match indoors, so they had it outdoors. So they all go in the ring, they do the announcements, yada, 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 set fire to the ropes, and, of course, the wind gets up. And it doesn't flame, it smokes. So Inita, Sabu, and Goto all clear the ring. But obviously, the Sheik can't move that quick, can you? So they had to douse all the water, get to the Sheik, who had some respiratory problems, but he was all right. But it was like they nearly killed him. It was just like, this is a really bad idea. Do you not think, also, from a viewer's point of view, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because all you see is smoke and flames. You don't see the wrestlers doing anything.
Yes.
It's just like, this is a bad idea all around.
It surprised me, too, because when he was carrying that flaming torch, it got so close to the mat, it got so close to the turnbuckles, and it was like, not a big deal. Not a big deal whatsoever.
Yeah, no.
And I was like, holy cow, like, this literally could have gotten bad really, really quickly. But, I mean, I guess it's also the appeal for him as well. Wouldn't you agree that it's one of those anything goes, expect the unexpected from a guy like this?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, they were allowed to do what they wanted. Now, bear in mind that Inita was a government spokesperson, so he had a bit of sway, and all those nice people with nice sharp suits, dark glasses, and tattoos in the front row were probably quite well-connected criminals. So, you know, they could get away with an awful lot, as long as you didn't touch them. There was an incident in one show where the Yakuza were landed on by a couple of Lucha stars, and Inita had to go and be very, very apologetic to make sure it never happened again. They could get away with a ton of stuff, essentially. I mean, you know, I'm listening to Jimmy Havoc, as a British wrestler, as a British hardcore wrestler, and explaining how he gets away with stuff. Like, how do you do a ladder match? And he explained on Out of Wrestling one day, well, here's the health and safety form I have to fill out for the building to fix it. And he's like, can you imagine doing, like, a health and safety check for this match?
You know, no, not a chance.
So, yeah. You know, this is the kind of thing that they didn't have to do back then. It was the 90s. It was the Wild West. They could do what they liked.
But they also got an audience over 50,000 people, so yeah. People were digging it.
We should talk about that. 58,000 people at
a lot of people.
Kawasaki Baseball Stadium, which wasn't the nicest of venues, to be honest with you, but it was at the end of a bullet train line, which is all you need. Carol, you saw the video of them setting up. What do you think of the building? Would you like to go see wrestling in that kind of environment?
You know what? I don't know. The documentary itself that kind of shows a lot of the making of and the following the wrestlers, you know, through the day of the event, and obviously the press conference leading up to it. It reminded me a lot of a WrestleMania. I mean, just as far as the way setting it up, but the event itself, I mean, just the outdoor element, I think it really appealed. But yeah, the venue itself was a little past its prime, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, they don't use it for a baseball stadium anymore. In fact, I'm not sure it's even there anymore. Because obviously real estate in Tokyo shifts and moves on a daily basis. I'm just trying to think what the WrestleMania was in 95 and what the numbers were like for that. I'm just having a quick look at that in the meantime. But yeah, it's an interesting place. You get to see more of it actually later as the matches go on, because they start using the arena a bit more for some variation, because obviously with FMW you've got a lot of violence and a lot of matches that were kind of like, what's the word there? they're kind of samey, I guess. So, you know, they try and create some variation. Yeah, WrestleMania in 1995 was at the Harford Civic Center and drew 16,000.
Yeah, that is literally just a fraction of what they're doing at this time. Yeah. I mean, but the production quality, I would say, was really, really good. I mean, the way they had set up the ring, the way they had done a lot of things, the camera work was really good. So, you know, watching this, you felt just as intimately as you were watching any other type of wrestling. But 58,000, I mean, that's a lot of people. What would you guess right now, James, was the average ticket price?
I would say probably cheap. I would probably say around about 20. Well, no, I mean, because it was his retirement match, it's probably around $30 to $40. I think it was a gate. I can't remember. There is a listing somewhere of, if I find it, I'm find the gate. Excuse me, listeners. There's a list of all the FMW anniversary shows somewhere, which actually has all the gate monies on them. I'm just trying to find it now.
Yeah, when it comes to FMW, let me ask you this question here. Did you find that, you know, we talked about the different types of crowds, you know, North American versus British versus Japanese. And the Japanese, I've always mentioned this before, really seem to address it more as a sporting event, more of an athletic competition. Now, with a lot of these matches on this card that do seem to be a little more gimmicky, do you feel like the crowd like that, or do you think they would have preferred to stay with more of the brutality, or was it kind of, you know, we'll take a little bit of both?
I think it's wrestling that reflects the audience. This is Kawasaki. This is essentially, if you want to like find a place in North America, it's Detroit, it's Philadelphia, it's Chicago, it's hard-working blue-collar guys. You know, this equivalent here is Manchester, Birmingham, Wolverhampton, factory workers. So I think there was kind of like an appeal to them that was different to what All Japan and what New Japan were offering. It's the same thing we say now, you know, like, why is Ring of Honor a success? Because it's not WWE. You know, there is a major advantage to not being something else. Just going back to what we were saying, Kawasaki 1995, $2.5 million take on the gate.
Unbelievable. Holy cow.
So, yeah. But yeah, a lot of appeal of FMW is it's not what anyone had seen before. It was something different, something, you know. And there's a very kind of, you look at the fan base, it's very 18 to 30 male in the same way ECW was, but it's not the same. These aren't bloodthirsty people. These are people who are looking for an outlet in a different way. Do you see what I mean? There's a certain...
No, absolutely.
There's a certain masculinity to it that today we'd probably feature as toxic masculinity, but it's not that. It's a very, you look at the audience and they're all well dressed, middle class, kind of working class, but well dressed. They've brought girlfriends. That's a different kind of audience than you expect for this type of stuff in North America.
Well, we're talking about the Kawasaki Stadium. They had run the show, I mean, which some people may or may not know, for 4 years.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They started with the 4th anniversary show. They went to the 7th on. And I mean, it was a continual buildup each year, you know, with the crowds and the attendance getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And man, 58,250, that's a hell of a crowd. I don't care for where you are in the world, because think about that. The following year, you had Terry Funk and Mr. Pongo versus Hayabusa and Tanaka, and it was almost 33,000 or 33,231. Yeah. So, you know, there was a drop-off for the next show.
Anita was worth 20,000 people easily, you know, and it's as well, you know, the power in those numbers, you know, they did it without TV.
Can you believe that?
Yeah, I mean, no TV.
How is somebody doing that without the power and the marketing of television?
Well, like you said, it is good production values. They had a deal. They got a $10,000 advance at the kind of half, about the 3rd anniversary show onwards. They got a $10,000 advance from a Laserdisc company, because obviously DVD hadn't been invented then. And they had a distribution deal with that Laserdisc company. And they were the ones, they put the money into cameras and to good production, got a good production truck, they got good directors, they concentrated on making good presentation, which wasn't something necessarily that New Japan were relying on, and All Japan relying on the TV companies to do that for them, but they were much more bespoke in what they could do, you know, and they recorded everything. They did every house show they did, you know, the tours in Mexico that they did as well, and had some really cracking matches. One of the Dave Meltzer 5-star matches was a 6-man tag they had in Mexico, in Los Angeles, just South Los Angeles, when they did a one-off show. A WAW show. So they were doing it on production value, and they were doing it on just word of mouth, really. Just developing that fan base and building it and building and building it.
Yeah, but I would, you know, looking back at this and just looking at the statistics and the numbers and whatnot, this has to be the pinnacle when it comes to anniversary shows. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. This was the biggest one by far. And, you know, the previous year with Tenryu was probably wasn't as good a match as this with Hayabusa. We'll get to the main event in a second, but the card was probably stronger, whereas this was a one-match card. There was only any reason to go to see that one match, if you see what I mean. The other matches, as good as they are, aren't that necessary, if you see what I mean.
No, I definitely do. One of those things where, like you said before, it's just kind of a build-up, you know, just kind of getting everybody ready for the main event, which, like you said earlier, it had to happen when it was dark out, or you would lose the complete aspect of what the promoter was trying to go for.
Yeah. Okay, then. So we'll move on to match seven. Takahashi Ishikawa, Apollo Sagawa, and Kishin Kawabata defeated Mitsuhiro Matsunaga, Hideki Hasaki, and Bad Boy Hido in 12 minutes and 35 seconds. I love Bad Boy Hido because he's named Bad Boy Hido, which is a brilliant name for a wrestler. They were all wing guys, and they come into the promotion as part of that invasion deal. And they were beaten by the hometown team, which kind of like sets off what happens with later with the wing guys. So we'll explain that in a bit. But it was a solid outing. It was a good match. What did you think of this?
I liked it. I liked the tag team match here because you saw a lot of different guys, you know, getting their move sets in here, and they were really working the crowd really well. It did remind me, it was very reminiscent of North American style wrestling as far as, you know, working the crowd, looking out at the audience, very, very good at going ahead and drawing a response from their opponents. And, you know, for a tag team match, it's really, really hard sometimes after you've gone and had so many other matches so far on the card right now that people have gotten really high for. So you almost are preparing yourself for a little bit of an emotional letdown. But this one definitely did not do it. It was really good. I love the concept of the submission holds as well.
Yeah.
So I was digging this one. It was good.
Cool. And then we move on to the woman with the perfect hair. Megumi Kudo defeated Bad Nurse Nakamura in a singles match for the FMW World, WWA World Women's Championships. 14 minutes and 32 seconds, and this was a bit of a personal feud. Bad Nurse Nakamura was backed up by her partners in Mad Dog Military, and Megumi Kudo was backed up by Combat Toyota, her old friend. This was just brilliant, just really good wrestling. Megumi Kudo is, obviously, as we've talked about many times on the Treepenny Show, one of the most underrated women's wrestlers that ever lived. She was absolutely fantastic in her ability to sell, and she comes into this very much as the underdog and brilliantly gets someone else to go to the ring so she can jump Bad Nurse Nakamura from behind because she's wearing a towel over her head.
Fantastic storytelling
there. Yeah, and everyone's looking at her, and it's the right person, the right haircut and everything, and then Kudo jumps Nakamura from behind, and it's just awesome. Because she's a badass babyface. She isn't going to sit around and wait for things to happen. She's going to take it to the opposition. And that's the story of Kudo. You know, you think she's this nice, good-looking young girl, but really she's a violent, violent human being. And she also ended up marrying Bad Boy Hido. So,
and I think that really adds, though, to the psychology of the storytelling with here. You know, because you think, you know, the persona of one person, you know, what you perceive them to be is one thing. But then when they get unleashed, it's a totally different story.
Yeah, it is. That's the thing. You know, she isn't. The nearest comparison is Minami Toyota, who's a very similar style of wrestler technically, and also the similar attitude. Minami Toyota was the biggest face in Japanese women's wrestling in the 90s. But if she needed to break the rules, she would do. It wasn't about being straight. It was about being the best wrestler in the world. And if you want to be the best wrestler in the world, sometimes you have to break the rules.
When it comes to women's wrestling in blood, and I don't know if I've ever asked you this before, it seems like it's a lot more commonplace in Japanese wrestling. Back in, you know, 1995, 1996, was it a lot more commonplace to see women bleed, or was it one of those things that they kind of held off for special matches?
You're much more likely to see it in the 80s than you were in the 90s, to be honest. The really violent stuff happened in the 80s. The 90s was much more of a pure kind of wrestling aesthetic, but in the 80s it was your Chigasun of the Crush Girls versus Dump Matsumoto and Bull Nakano were some of the most violent wrestling matches I ever saw. You know, there was like Dump would come with a pair of scissors, she'd slice open the referee within the first 3 minutes, never mind her opponent.
Jeez.
So, you know, you watch some of them matches and they're like, they're intense. Whereas in the 90s it became much more of a kind of more flowing wrestling athletic style. It was more about big bumps, high risks. FMW was much more about that kind of more intense storytelling. The violence was part of it, but it was kind of like Echoing the Men in the sense of it's about intense personal rivalry, and blood kind of amplifies that story. Do you see what I mean?
Whereas, no, I do.
Yeah, whereas AJW was much more of a classical wrestling aesthetic. Don't get me wrong, there was blood in AJW as well. One of the bloodiest matches you're ever likely to see is Akira Hokuto versus, I can't remember now, from Dream Slam 2. But you know the Dream Slam Saloon match with Akira Hokuto, which we talked about before, and I can't remember her name, and I can see her in my eye, but I can't remember what she's called. You watch that match, that's one of the bloodiest matches I've ever seen. But this was kind of more example of where FMW was at. It wasn't blood for blood's sake, it was blood to expand the storyline, if you see what I mean. Bad Nurse Nakamura as well needed the help. She was a rookie. She'd only come to the company in the previous 2 years, so anything she could do to set herself out as special was well worth it. But she was attacking Megumi Kudo with a can.
Yeah, spray paint can. I saw yes. that, and I was like, what is it? Well, I couldn't get a really good shot of it, what it was, and I was like, that's a spray paint can.
Yeah, you know, when you got guys in this company wielding a sickle, then you'd have thought you could have come up with something sharper than a spray paint can.
I was just about to say, wait a minute. I feel like she got the bad end of the stick when yes. it came to the weapons for the match,
sharp
because
objects.
She's got some Krylon, and this other guy's got something that could take your head off.
Yeah, but there you go. But what did you think of the actual wrestling though?
The wrestling match, in my opinion, I will honestly say this, and this may get some negative reviews from people, but it was my favorite match. It was my favorite cool. match on the card for the simple fact that the storytelling, like you said before, was so good. The moves were crisp. They were well done. The emotion was extremely high from both of the participants. The crowd was definitely in it, and they didn't rely on a lot of, I don't want to say gore,
no.
but they were more focused on the physical, whatever you can do, I can do better. And, you know, as far as being able to sell, these girls sold their butts off, and it was so, so good. I don't know what Dave Meltzer would have given a match like this, but personally, it was my favorite of the night.
Cool. Well, we kind of move on to the big heavy hitters of FMW in the next few matches. Katsushi Naeyama and Masato Tanaka. Yes, that Masato Tanaka. We start talking about him now. Defeated Horace Boulder, the nephew of Hulk Hogan, with the best skullet I've seen in pro wrestling. Horace had actually dyed his hair black to accentuate the fact he was going bald.
Oh my God. That must be a family thing right there, yes. because that looked so atrociously bad. I was like, wait a minute, what is this? And it was pretty rough.
Yes. And the gladiator, Mike Awesome. And they lost in 10 minutes and 25 seconds to a slew of swear words from Horace Boulder at the end
Holy
of the
cow. I mean, you
awesome.
Know, in the United States, we talk about putting a quarter in the cuss jar, and they should have just wrote out a personal check.
I do like that, though, from Horace Boulder. Like, as soon as he gets grout caught in a German suplex, he knows he's going over, and it's just like, oh, shit. It's just like, that. But that's the reaction you would want, isn't it? Like, oh, bugger it. Damnation.
You know, when it comes to these two guys, I mean, obviously the answer is going to be Mike Awesome here, because I feel like he was a lot more over with the Japanese crowd. Was Horace a popular guy, or was he kind of one of those guys who just kind of came in with Mike and it was more of Mike was the attraction?
He stuck around for a while. There was also Rick Bogner, who you probably mostly remember of being the fake Razor Ramon in WWE.
Yes.
There was a six-man tag team. They considered themselves the best damn six-man tag team in wrestling, Horace and the Gladiator and Rick. And they were pretty damn good, and Horace was always a fair attraction. He's a pretty good hand. To be honest, I think he's probably a better wrestler than his uncle is as an in-ring worker, and he certainly has psychology down as a heel. And Masato Tanaka and Naeyama are pretty good babyfaces to work against, so this was a bit of a rock and roll match, and the fans were into it big.
Yeah, they were. They were definitely into this one right now. And the climbing on the scaffolding, I want to talk to you about this one as well, because I was like, wait a minute. There was a moment in time when I thought Mike Awesome literally was going to fall all the way. But luckily, I guess his foot got caught and he didn't take a terrible spill. But it had the appeal of everything. And they took this match everywhere in the arena as well. So depending on where the fan was sitting, they definitely got a taste of everything in this match.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was a kind of a Mike Awesome thing that he would climb the scaffold every anniversary show, so it had to happen. because he'd done it the previous years. And once you've given that expectation, you can't disappoint it, can you? So he had to go higher up the scaffolding, which is kind of like a little mini metaphor for the problems with FMW.
Yeah, whatever we did last year, which was fantastic, we have to go above that again this year. So.
Exactly. So there you go. But it was good and well worth a watch. Also well worth a watch was Lethal Weapon, Hisakatsu Oya, and Riki Fuji, who had managed to get his bird's nest mullet under control for once. They defeated Mr. Pogo and Wing Kanemura in 12 minutes and 45 seconds. Mr. Pogo swinging his sickle as per normal. Wing Kanemura, that bastion of common sense. And, yes, and it was a slice and dice job, but the fans absolutely adored it. This was like watching the Rock and Roll Express and the Legion of Doom Road Warriors in the 1980s. This was like big badass heels in the biggest badass way, going against two big baby faces in Riki Fuji and Hisuki Oya, who would be heels again the following month. But in this particular case, they were over like Rover as baby faces, and the fans lapped this up, even though it wasn't necessarily the best wrestling match in the world. What did you think of this, Mike?
No, I liked it too, and I'm on par with you when it comes to this could have been a lot more technically sound. They could have done a lot more in the ring, because obviously all four guys are ridiculously talented, and it did turn into more of a brawl, because you felt like it was more of a kind of a hated rivalry there. But when they did get in the ring and when they did go ahead and put some moves together and sequence them, they looked really good. And like you said before, you often wonder if a lot of the North American wrestlers, you know, kind of kept an eye on what was going on in Japan, because this was so reminiscent of what tag team wrestling would eventually end up looking like in places like WWF and in WCW, because the tag team divisions here in Japan, would you agree, they work so well together and they do elect such a great response from the audience. Did they ever, to your knowledge, break tag teams up very often, or did once they were a tag team, did they pretty much stay with each other?
They worked the other way around. So like, certainly up until this point, if you look at the FMW like championships, there's a women's championship, there's a men's tag team championship, there's a men's championship. So titles meant a lot more. So if you were a tag team champion, you were automatically a number one contender for the heavyweight championship. I mean, in New Japan now, it's getting a bit silly in some senses, because you've got six mans, you've got regular tags, you've got junior heavyweight tags, and then you've got four singles titles. Or, you know, as someone said, 3.5 singles titles. Sai said three. He was discussing the Never Open Weight Championship and said, well, Sai said, well, it's kind of half a championship, especially while Elgin's got it. Anyway, the tag team titles suddenly become much more important, and you had some great tag teams, but they were great singles wrestlers, if you see what I mean. If you look at All Japan in 92, was probably the best period of tag team wrestling in Japan, because you had Johnny Ace and Kota Kobashi, you had Doc and Gordy, Stan Hansen and Dan Spivey. You know, Stan Hansen had four or five tag team partners in his run in All Japan, but Bruiser Brody passed away. Ted DiBiase went to be the million-dollar man. Dan Spivey's knees finally gave up, and Big Van Vader was his last major long-running tag partner. So, you know, you've got four guys who've naturally, it's natural progression of why these teams broke up. It's because they've left the company or they've retired. It isn't to do with, you know, they're not like, say, the Road Warriors or the Rockers or the Hart Foundation of the same era. They're two singles guys who have separate careers, you know. Nowadays you tend to think of things differently. I was listening to Kenny Omega this week, and he was talking about the Golden Lovers and getting his run at Okada. He'd actually bulked up weight because he thought he was going to be a tag wrestler for a while. You know, I'm going to be tagging with Kota Ibushi. We're probably going to go after the Young Bucks and the new IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championships. I need to put some weight on to carry the matches. And then all of a sudden, are you wrestling Okada in a no time limit best of three falls match? Right then, best lose some weight quick. So, you know, there's a lot different kind of feel to what Japanese tag wrestling is like. So you're right, in the sense of they didn't break tag teams up as much, but there wasn't such a reliance on name tag teams. Guys were not going to work together for 10 years. They were probably going to work together for 2 or 3 years in a faction, or they were going to work for a longer term. And they didn't swap and change things around so much because they didn't really need to. The storylines are much more static. The, like, for instance, the NWO storyline that kind of finishes in, what, 1999 in WCW as a 3-year run. It was kind of extended to like 2003 in New Japan, and it's the same storyline. You know, it was a much longer kind of idea, and this is the kind of thing here. FMW was probably chopped and changed faces to heels much quicker than most Japanese companies did, but again, they were burning through stuff, and they were having to create conflict. They had to turn people around.
Well, when you talk about, you know, they were burning through different storylines and whatnot, I guess the one thing that I'm always kind of wondering about is the guys that you just named who obviously went on to WWF and WCW, would you say that the company itself was just done with their run, or do you think it was more the lure of the money that was something that took them back to North America?
With like the guys
Ted DiBiase and with like maybe Vader and you know, some of the other guys like Stan Hansen, do you think at the end of the day they wanted to come back and to make more, or do you think maybe not necessarily they were making a pretty good coin over in Japan?
Yeah, it completely depends on the guy. I mean, there's also a point like, you know, even with WWE, the money was better in that particular time period, you know, for Ted DiBiase to be in WWE than it would have been from in All Japan. For Stan Hansen, it wouldn't be.
And I can see that too, because, yeah, you know, obviously it's very niche when it comes to that. And, you know, if you're not somebody who's going to be getting over, then you're not really, you know, selling tickets, or you're not really drawing people to the arena. So I get that, especially when North American wrestling was very gimmicky and was very based upon, you know, kids, and they were going into more of a family-oriented area, and they were creating and designing characters that would draw more families to the arenas. So I could definitely see that.
I mean, you know, just to interrupt, to give you an idea, Dynamite Kid was talking about his All Japan run in the late 90s. Well, his All Japan run on the late 90s with Johnny Smith when they were British Bruisers, after him and David Wood split up. And they were a kind of mid-card tag team, and they were on a $10,000 guarantee, $10,000 bonus if they worked through the year, $2,000 a night, 2 weeks tours, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off.
Oh, wow.
Guaranteed. And if they did well, they got bonuses.
That's ridiculous. That's really, really good. I mean, you know, for the landscape of what wrestling was at that time, that's good money.
You know, and they had to work hard for that. You know, those 2 weeks were hell on earth, but they got 2 weeks off. This is the kind of conversation we're having at the minute as on the Troopany Show generally. It's something we talk about quite a lot, because you look at WWE schedule where you're wrestling five nights a week, you're traveling all around the world. Is it any better than wrestling for New Japan, where you're in intense matches maybe once a month, but you're wrestling six-man tags for 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off? What's actually, you know, this is a big conversation that's going to be the future of pro wrestling, I think, is like, you know, we talk about strong style being hard on the body, and it is, don't get me wrong, but equally it is like, it's also much more protective in other ways.
No, I would agree. And one thing I wanted to throw back here to this match that we're talking about right now, and I don't know exactly everything that's going on, because it's so hard, obviously, because there's no subtitles or whatnot. And,
no, there's not even Japanese commentary for you to get the high points.
Yeah, there's nothing. And the funny, do rules even exist? Because this guy just literally took a sickle and was cutting his shoulder open, and it looked like the referee was almost like holding his arm down to the ground. So I'm like, well, who the hell's on whose side at this point? And do rules even exist? Or maybe that was the nature of what the gimmick was for this match.
This match was for the FMW Brass Knuckles Tag Team Championship, which was...
Well, there you go, James. The Brass Knuckles Championship.
Yes.
It's perfect.
Of course. Now, the Brass Knuckles Championships actually started in Texas back in the 1950s. I'm trying to remember the guy. Basically, there was a couple of guys in Texas who were a bit rough, and the Texas promoters at the time were petitioning the NWA for them to be the World Heavyweight Champion, because they were a massive draw. And the NWA were going like, no. Because we don't want these bloody gory death bloodbaths to be like the calling card at the NWA. Of course not. So they gave them a title to keep them quiet.
Kind of like hush money right there.
Yeah, essentially. Now, here, defend this belt and just keep it well away from us.
Nice.
Yes, and that Tsuchi Onita picked up on that title, kind of that, which was kind of the precursor to hardcore titles and what you saw in WWE in the 90s. And that became their kind of like their thing. The Brass Knuckles Championship was their heavyweight title. You know, they took this lineage of these old Texas hardcore charges and applied it to modern wrestling.
The referees definitely get more involved in these matches than I've seen before. I mean, the physically grabbing the wrestlers and holding them back and when someone else has a sickle, it tickles me to see this.
Yeah, Pogo was massively influential. He passed away last year. And a lot of the British guys, obviously Jimmy Havoc, who's a deathmatch wrestler by trade, was very influenced by Mr. Pogo. But a lot of guys like Chris Brooks of the CCK was influenced by Mr. Pogo as well. And he went on Twitter and explained the influence of his mannerisms and how that influenced him. Though Chris isn't a deathmatch wrestler, he very much took into what Mr. Pogo was doing. Funnily enough, as far as inspirations is concerned, Dahlia Black, who is a big name in progress wrestling in the UK, was actually a massive fan of Megumi Kudo, I found out last night, because on Twitter she said in her debut match she wanted to make her gear look as much like Megumi Kudo as possible.
Wow.
There you go, you see. So these guys do influence people. This was kind of like the era of tape trading as well. Like, you know, a lot of this stuff got passed around in the UK, especially because of tape trading. So that's really where its core audience came from. A lot of the older people my age who I talked to on Twitter found this stuff via tape trading originally. My old boss at WrestleTalk, Alex Shane, funnily enough, told the story on the Daily Squash one morning about the fact that he took this into school for his media studies project and how this would, like we said, you know, what the wonder of the world of FMW, that they'd managed to draw 58,000 people to an arena with no television.
And, wow.
And then his teachers were going like, where did you get this?
I was just about to say, are your parents aware you are doing this?
Should we be calling some help? No, it's just
Yes,
but so this match was one of the darker matches on this particular card, but thoroughly entertaining, and the crowd were into it. But the reason why the crowd were into it was because of this main event. Tatsushi Onita, in his retirement match, defends his FMW Brass Knuckles Heavyweight Championship in a no-rope exploding barbed wire death match. In 18 minutes and 11 seconds. Missed this off the description on Wikipedia. It's actually a no-rope exploding barbed wire cage time bomb double hell death match. Very important distinction. Let me allow you the rules there. There is essentially not many. pinfalls or submissions for the winner. Bomb goes off at 15 minutes. No ropes. Cage replaces the ropes. The cage has got barbed wire in them with electrified barbed wire. So, or exploding barbed wire. Usually was electrified, which gives you a nice bang and some loads of smoke. What did you think of this, Mike?
The only thing you're missing here is like rabid dogs being in the ring with them at the same time.
I love the siren. The first time I watched the first one of these I watched was Terry Funk and Tatsushi Onita from the third anniversary or the fourth anniversary. And like the siren goes off and I'm going, what the hell's happening? I was like, oh, that'll be for the time bomb then. Yes. This was unreal. Now, Hayabusa we'd talked about him a lot before on previous anniversary shows because he was usually in the opening match. He'd come back from Mexico after an excursion, and Onita was looking to make the next star to carry on FMW's legacy when he left. And Hayabusa had really connected with the audience, and to make him even more sympathetic, essentially he begs Onita for 6 months to be his opponent. Actually, no, I think it's from the previous year's press conference. He comes back to FMW. He was called back from excursion. And the first job is beg Onita for the retirement match. And Onita wouldn't listen to him. And this story happens for a year that eventually Hayabusa gets this retirement match opportunity on the biggest show FMW ever do. You'll bear in mind, like 3 years earlier, he was in the opening matches on those Kawasaki cards. And he showed an incredible amount of potential. What do you think of this match, Mike? Because there's an awful lot going on here for the first timer.
No, there is so much going on. There's so much stimuli to kind of take in here. I guess the first thing that makes me the first question I have, I should say, was what was the time frame difference between the previous match and when this match happened? Because it was getting towards dusk. Now it's just completely pitch black, and I wonder what it took to go ahead and get all this set up, or was this something that was already put together and they just had to go ahead and fasten it along the ring posts? Do you have any background on that information? Or
not really. I mean, I've only seen a couple of cages set up in real time. Like I was at the Pro Wrestling Eve Wrestle Queendom show at the York Hall, and it took them about 25 minutes to take down a cage. So I can imagine it's probably going to take you at least 40 minutes to get it all up. And it'll be the young boys and girls who are usually putting the cage together as well. There's usually one small rookie lady with barbed wire wrapping around. This small 18-year-old girl with a reel of barbed wire and heavy-duty gloves on wrapping this barbed wire around the cage or around the ring ropes. So yeah, I would guess it's probably around about 25 to 40 minutes. So you got to, they had some patience just to sit there in Kawasaki and twiddle their thumbs for 40 minutes whilst they got this destructive thing together.
Yeah, and then the other thing that definitely stands out, I mean, it's just the entrance. You know, the entrance of the two wrestlers was awesome because, you know, it was such a great buildup. It almost felt like a Starrcade, you know, when Flair would come out, because it had that very symbolic type of feel to it. Because, you know, a lot of people, this was the final time. And you soak it all in, take it all in, because, you know, you're not going to see this again. And then when they finally got in there, they did the respect handshake, which I thought, you know, at least from my perspective, it looked like that. And it was just, they were both so good from a psychological standpoint, being able to tell this story. And then the referee looked like he was going to go snow skiing. It was just like, what the hell is going on here? Because he reminds me of, if you remember, Back to the Future, Doc. You know, he looked like him, but these guys literally, they tore the house down and they used the props liberally. The buzzer, like I said before, when you had mentioned it, that's when the explosives were going to be going off, the C4, and it took me by surprise because I had never seen that before in a match. So yeah. I had seen barbed wire matches, but I had never seen explosives added.
No, it's something special. It really is. And no one really does this anymore for good reason. It's expensive. You know, doing this job, C4 explosive, apart from the fact that you would probably get arrested for terrorist acts in this day and age, it's
very true.
It's expensive to do. You know, this is expensive matches to put together, and they didn't spend a ton of money. You know, they spent money on the building a little bit, but you know, they didn't have a massive budget to swing around when it came to this stuff. And you know, they are working incredibly safe in these matches. Relatively speaking, you notice no one's taking massive, huge bumps in these matches because they're landing on barbed wire and getting blown up. So no one's being particularly rough with each other. but it is, you know, it's, and it also becomes about human drama. It's not about, suddenly a headlock becomes massively more important. And they work a headlock for like 4 minutes.
You know, I agree.
You know, and it becomes like this life or death situation because it is. You know,
well, because every move could very much lead to something, you know, being thrown into the barbed wire. And it was one of those things where everything they did elicited such a great response. And the moves that they did, the move sets that they put together were very, very tactfully done. And when someone did finally hit the barbed wire, it was a well build up for a good pop from the crowd.
Yeah, it's so well told. And it's probably Anita's best outing. Hayabusa was a great aerial wrestler. The only thing I don't like about this match is Hayabusa was arguably the best aerial wrestler in the world. He was the Japanese equivalent of Sabu, but safer and much more graceful. And you don't get to see that because it's inside a cage with no ropes on it. You know, he does one high spot off the top of the cage. But apart from that, which is breathtaking, but apart from that, it's all about bumps and barbed wire and explosions. It's about human drama. And it kind of proves that he can hang in the FMW kind of style. There was a lot of people in this roster, until they could hang in barbed wire matches, weren't considered good enough by the FMW fans because they built that kind of fan base around it. Megumi Kudo didn't get over till she had her first barbed wire match. You know, there was, you had to get over in the FMW way. Combat Toyota became Combat Toyota after she had her first barbed wire match, and Natsushi Anita said she's worth a nickname, and Combat Toyota is her nickname. So, you know,
it almost makes you feel like they got to pay their dues before they're, you know, accepted by the crowd.
Yeah, big rites of passage moments in these matches, you know, and that's what this is. And it proved it was worthwhile. $2.5 million. And I'm not saying how much Hayabusa saw of that $2.5 million. Anita probably saw a fair bit more. But yeah, it was something special. And Anita goes into retirement, and you get the full Anita, the full eyes glaring at you, the pointing, the whole Anita package. It is something special. Now, you know, we'll talk about in a minute about what happened after this, but What do you think of Anita as a person? Because he's just persuaded 58,000 people into a building to watch two people blow each other up.
An unbelievable talent. You know, we often talk about performers from their skill set in the ring itself.
Yeah,
but like you said before, from the press conference that was very emotional based. I mean, you know, when you see that before you see this match and you see all the buildup that goes into this and you hear the comments that they make, you know, leading up to this as well, it's all of that drama that goes into it. And it's one of those things where when you take an individual who has so much charisma, so much ability, and that person is, you know, a large part, if not all of it, of the reason why so many people have come to see you, that really is a testament of who you are as a performer. And they've just gone into the cage right now. I'm watching this as we're doing the show. Cool.
Yeah,
and I thought they lost power at the whole arena, but no. But he's so good, and I think when you have people like that who can touch the fans and who can make people side with you and understand, you know, where you're coming from and the emotion, it's almost what you do in the ring almost comes secondary, because I feel like you've reached such a high pinnacle right now with your connection that it can't drop any lower than that.
No, this is it. This is what it is for me. This is the kind of crux of FMW is Anita. I've always said that the roster of FMW didn't need the window dressing, as it were, of the barbed wire and the explosives. And they didn't, because they were all creative guys. And me and Chelsea have talked about before, these were the people that weren't good enough for All Japan Women, who weren't tough enough for, or were too weird for All Japan Pro Wrestling, or weren't athletic enough for New Japan Pro Wrestling. These were the guys that scuffed around North America and Puerto Rico and all the places no one wants to work to make a living, and then they found this home in FMW. You know, how many of those women in that dojo would never have been pro wrestlers if it wasn't for the FMW dojo? Like four or five of them. You know, there is a bunch of stuff going on in FMW that's well worth it, and just because it's not crisp and clean and perfect wrestling that you expect from other Japanese promotions doesn't mean it's not worthwhile. And at the end of the day, 58,000 people in a building because of essentially one match.
Would you agree that in some ways FMW can kind of translate, or you can draw a connection between them and an ECW from the standpoint of, you know what, these were the people that couldn't, you know, if you want to use the phrase, couldn't hang with, you know, the WCWs or the WWFs, but they found their niche here, and that ended up being so well positioned for them for their career that they became bigger stars there than they would have gone anywhere else.
Oh, undoubtedly. Paul Heyman lifted the blueprint for ECW lock, stock, and barrel from FMW.
You can clearly see it. Yeah. It has ECW written all over it. And when you look at the time set, and because, you know, ECW before it became Extreme was just East Coast Championship Wrestling.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It wasn't even the Extreme stuff. So yeah, Paul definitely got a lot of his ideas and a lot of the wrestlers from this promotion.
Oh yeah. I mean, Hayabusa wrestled for ECW. Anita was planned to, but never did. He retired not long after this before he did. Ricky Fuji, I think, went to ECW. Obviously, Gladiator Mike, of course, and Masato Tanaka had a feud over the ECW Heavyweight Championship. Damien 666 went. The Sheik was originally in the old East Coast Championship Wrestling from Philadelphia, because he was obviously a hardcore legend, and the ECW Philly fans loved him for it. But yeah, there is a very straight line. I mean, ECW and FMW do work together in a couple of years down the line. There is a brilliant story that Bully Ray tells about the Sandman, right? the Dudleys and Tommy Dreamer and the Sandman are supposed to be an eight-man tag.
Okay. Oh, okay. This one. Okay.
In FMW, and they're in a room, and there's Anita and his three tag partners, and there's the Dudleys and Tommy and Sandman and Paul Heyman. And Anita's chain smoking, and he has a young boy lighting cigarettes for him.
As he goes through. Terrible.
Anyway, and it's Sandman, right? Now he's probably had a few of some other things that he's managed to sneak through the Tokyo airport as well. Anyway, everything they're trying to figure out an ending for this match, and everyone's quiet and don't say anything, because if they piss off Anita, the whole deal's off. And then after about 3 minutes of silence, Sandman goes, "I got it."
That's pretty good.
"I got it. You Jap me, and I'll Pearl Harbor you."
Oh, my. my God.
And it said, like, Bubba Ray and Devon look at each other, and they look at Paul, and they look at each other, and they look at Paul, and then they look at Tommy, and Tommy's looking at Anita, and Anita just goes to his translator, and nothing happens for a second, and then he goes, puts his cigarette out, no, and then moves, and then they move on, and they got this. He said, I'm like, we're never getting out of here alive. But yes, so ECW and FMW were hilarious together, put it that way.
That's classic Sandman. You're good at doing the impersonation there. Have you ever done any other ones on the show?
Not very many, no. Sandman's easy, though. You just kind of, like, gravel up your voice and imagine you smoked since you were 3 years old, and it's easy. yes, so this card, FMW 5th or 6th anniversary, was a mega drawing card. It is really important, and I think you should watch it. I will give you the pre-warning that it's pretty violent. I can't get away from that fact. But there's some good stuff, and it's well worth it from watching the entire 6 year story culminate in the fact that they managed to get 58,000 people into an arena and $2.5 million, and they did it without television. It can be done. No internet either. No viral marketing. It was all word of mouth. So to wrap it up for us, Mike, what's your takeaway from this event? Now you've watched the whole thing, and thank you very much for watching it as joining us today. What do you feel about FMW and how it's part in wrestling history now as you're kind of getting into Japanese wrestling for the first time?
It definitely has its place in history, because when you look at what the promotion was doing, they were doing some groundbreaking stuff that obviously, you know, spilled over into North America and was very influential in what we just talked about, ECW. And then you saw, you know, subsequently in WWE later years, getting more intense with the barbed wire and the hardcore matches. But the crowd in it and what they were able to draw at that time, 58,000 people, the women's wrestling was bar none, in my opinion. It was some of the greatest that I had ever witnessed before. Yeah, there is a lot of brutality, but I think if you look at the psychology and you look at how strong the performers were, and you watch this event for what it is, and you can kind of block out some of the blood, the performers did an amazing job. There was never really a lull point, if you will. I feel like it continued to climax with each match, and it was booked really well too, because I was looking back at the card going, well, what happens if you would have moved this match over to here? But no, the way they booked it was really, really well. And to answer your question about getting into Japanese wrestling, I think I'm going to even explore it even more, and I think anyone who is a wrestling fan or someone who considers themselves a wrestling aficionado, you need to really put a lot of focus and for energy on watching Japanese wrestling, because a lot of the things that you may enjoy in a lot of other promotions around the world did originally come from Japan, and they have done an amazing job, and they continue to do a great job today. But this specific event was a great one to go ahead and kind of, you know, break my way into it. And I think I'm going to continue to watch it going on to the next anniversary show.
Excellent. I'm glad you liked it. Now, the next story after that is what did FMW do next? And the company starts to get based around Hayabusa. We'll talk more about that in a few episodes' time when we get to the 7th anniversary show, because that has an incredible double main event to look forward to. Terry Funk and Mr. Boko versus Masato Tanaka and Hayabusa, and Combat Toyota versus Megumi Kudo in a no-rope exploding double-held death barbed wire match for Combat Toyota's retirement match. So we're talking about that in a few weeks' time, and Chelsea did promise me that she would definitely be there for that one, because it's her favourite death match, and it's my favourite death match too, so we've got that to look forward to. Thank you very much for listening today. Next week, we will be at Strong Style Evolved in Altrincham, or Manchester, depending on how many shows we can get caught up on this week. we are looking at the Strong Style Evolved Tour in the UK. Ishii and Minoru Suzuki over the Rev Pro British Heavyweight Championship. Oh, dad fight that, proper. All right then, we'll be talking about that next week. I'd like to thank my guest today, Mr. Mike Freeland. Have you anything you would like to plug, sir?
Yeah, definitely. You know, cruise on over to TotalWrestlingMagazine.co.uk. Great magazine over there. We have a great podcast called the Total Wrestling Writers Podcast. You can go ahead and find that on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, FM Player, or anywhere else fine podcasts are made available. But love Japanese wrestling. I love the fact that, you know, you've put so many installments out here to help the beginners actually start to understand Japanese wrestling. So the Trupenny Show, I cannot give you guys enough credit. You guys have done an awesome job for me. I can sit by the pool or I can sit in my living room and I can kind of get an education and then watch shows like this and kind of put it all together. And hopefully soon I'll be able to come back and sound even more articulate on the topic of Japanese wrestling.
Well, thank you very much. Where can we find you on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media outlets?
Yes, I am on Twitter at Mike Freeland, MikeFreeland. Not really on Facebook, just mainly on Twitter right now. Hit me up with any of your questions. Shoot me a DM. I'd love to interact with any questions you have about wrestling. If you have anything that you would like to promote, any wrestlers who are looking to go ahead and get interviewed, be more than happy to go ahead and set something like that up with you. So just love talking wrestling and love interacting with the fans.
Okay, you can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter. You can also find the show at Trupenny Show on Twitter. And you can find us on Facebook, The Trupenny Show, and Patreon, where you can keep The Trupenny Show free forever for everyone. If you do want to sponsor The Trupenny Show, I don't plug this very often, but please send us a DM on Twitter, either to me or to the show. We would love a sponsor. It'd be really, really nice because it helps with the costs, because obviously SoundCloud does cost us money to post the thing, and then it goes out to all the other podcast providers. So anything to do that to help us keep this show free forever, which is really what we want to do, because guides like this are going to increase wrestling fandom, and the more fans we have, there's more of us and less of them. That's what I'm looking for. All right, thank you very much for listening this week. Next week we're back with Strong Style Evolved, but for now we hope you enjoyed FMW's 6th anniversary. You can find it loads of different places on the internet, because no one's going to sue you, trust me. Take care, and we'll see you next week. Bye.